This is Kirk Benroot for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. So who's with me?
I'm Heather Boggs.
I am Jim Prunin.
I am Mike Edwards.
My name is Lydia Spidiakov.
I'm Derek Frost.
Fatal Glass Eye, retold by S.E. Schlosser. My friend Liverpool Jarge was a small man, wiry and tough, but soft-spoken. Jarge had one glass eye that was an ugly shade of blue, which clashed something terrible with his real eye, which was brown. Then one day, Jarge met up with a glassblower, a real artist, who could make him a special red eye with a star. After that, he started collecting glass eyes. They were the fanciest things you ever did see, with stars and pretty stripes and more colors than any real eyes could ever have. I went with Jarge when he placed his next order. By that time, he had so many glass eyes that he was hard to please. So I kidded Jarge that he should get an evil eye. Right away, the glass blower said he could make a glass eye that was hollow so it could be filled with deadly poison. Jarge was as pleased as punch, saying that a man never knew when he might get to the place where he'd want to commit suicide, and what could be easier than to pop the eye into his mouth and bite down. Well, me and Jarge signed on to the same ship, and Jarge's new eye was delivered the day before we set sail. What a creepy eye it was, too, the perfect evil eye. It was made up of rings of color that narrowed into a single red spot. If you looked at it just right, the colors ran together, and the red spot popped out and would scare the life out of you. It was hollow, too, like the man promised, and filled with a white liquid. Jarge tried that evil eye on everyone on board ship, including me. Scared the bejesus out of me, and I had already seen the blasted thing. Of course, all of us told him to lay off or we'd brain him. All of us except a little cockney feller name of Bell. Everyone called Bell Ding Dong on account of his name. Bell nearly shriveled up with fright each time Jarge appeared with the glass eye. Jarge was tickled to death by Ding Dong Bell's reaction and took to plaguing the life out of him, putting the evil eye on him whenever he passed until Ding Dong truly thought he was bewitched. So the other men told Ding Dong Bell that he had to steal the evil eye. Of course, Jarge overheard them and he kept the eye hidden from Ding Dong. Turned out that the harder the eye was to steal, the more Ding Dong believed that stealing it was the only way to lift his curse. Finally, Jarge started wearing the evil eye all the time, to protect it, he claimed, though in truth it was to torment Ding Dong. One day, while he was docked in Port Said, Jarge went aloft on a foot rope to scrape a spar. Well, something must have fetched loose, because suddenly I heard a yell, and when I turned around, Jarge was plummeting 40 feet headfirst onto the deck, cracked his skull open like an eggshell, and his evil eye came rolling out. This was Ding Dong Bell's chance. He darted out from a corner and grabbed up the eye. When he saw the mate running toward us, he popped the eye into his mouth to hide it from the mate. In less than a minute, old Ding Dong Bell started shivering and fell dead on the deck, right beside poor Jarge. He'd accidentally bit into the eye and swallowed the poison hidden inside. What with Jarge and Ding both being dead, I figured maybe there was something in that evil eye business after all, and I was real glad it was gone.
Express Train to Hell, a New Jersey ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. For days, a ragged old man had hung around the Newark Central Station. The station master kept running him off, but night after night he would return. He kept accosting people, shouting, "It's coming for me! It's coming!" Whenever anyone asked him what was coming for him, he would just clutch his head and cry, "I done wrong! I killed a man that cheated me at cards, and now I'm gonna pay!" The station master finally took the man aside and threatened to call the police if he did not cease and desist. The old man rolled his eyes and replied, "The express train for hell is coming for my soul. You've got to help me." He broke away from the station master and ran for the door. The time was 2 minutes to midnight. At that moment, a new sound introduced itself. A long whistle blew. Once, twice, the station master was startled. The next train wasn't due until 12:05. The old tramp started screaming when he heard the whistle. The station master could hear the roar and chug of a steam train approaching fast, approaching too fast to stop at the station. The old man was standing at the edge of the platform, staring down the tracks in frozen terror. The station master ran forward and grabbed hold of the old tramp to pull him out of harm's way. The train whistle sounded again. A warm rush of air blew against everyone near the platform, and the station master heard the roar of an invisible train passing directly in front of him. He heard the hiss of the steam and the screech of flanges against iron rails. He felt the wind whipping our hairs and faces, but he saw nothing. Beneath his grip, the old tramp gave a terrible wail. Then he vanished, leaving the station master empty-handed. The roar of the invisible train faded into the distance and then ceased. The station master glanced at the station clock. It was midnight. The station master stared blankly at the tracks. Around him, the waiting passengers and other bystanders were gasping and murmuring in fright. "Good Lord, he was right," the station master murmured to himself. "It did come for him." He pulled out a handkerchief and wiped his sweating, bald head with it. A trembling man standing nearby approached the station master. "Sir, what was that?" he asked. "Son, I believe that was the express train to hell," said the station master. He shook his head, and that seemed to bring him to his senses. "Why don't you go back into the station and pour yourself a drink?" he suggested to the trembling man. He pushed the man through the station door and then turned to address the dazed and frightened passengers. "Nothing to worry about, folks," he said. "It was just an express train passing through. The next train will be here in 5 minutes." The station master's reassuring manner calmed everyone. People turned away from the empty tracks and settled back into their seats, whispering to each other about the strange events that had just taken place. Then the station master went into his office, closed the door, and poured himself a stiff drink to calm his nerves. "Well, that's one for the books," he muttered aloud. "I wonder if I should put it on the schedule. 12 a.m., express train to hell." Shaking his head, he fortified himself with one more brandy and then went back to work.
El Muerto, a Texas ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. After getting the lay of the land, so to speak, frontier man Bigfoot Wallace moved from Austin to San Antonio, which was considered the extreme edge of the frontier, to sign up as a Texas Ranger under Jack Hays. In them days, Texas was as wild as the West could get. There was danger from the South and the Mexicans. Danger to the west and north from the wild frontier, filled with Indians and desperados. And to the east, the settlement still had problems with the Cherokee Nation. General Sam Houston himself had appointed young Captain Hays, a hero from the Battle of Plum Creek, to raise a company of Rangers to defend San Antonio. Hays had high standards for his men. They were the best fighters in the west, and they had to be, considering the fact that they were often outnumbered 50-1. Man had to have courage, good character, good riding and shooting skills, and a horse worth $100 to be considered for the job. Captain Hays knew all about Bigfoot Wallace and signed him on the spot. So armed with Colt pistol and a Bowie knife, Texas Ranger Bigfoot Wallace once more took on the Wild West and quickly made his mark on Texas folklore. In them days, the Rangers tended to handle stock theft at the end of the rope, so to speak, stringing up the bandits, forcing a confession out of them, and then leaving the bodies swaying in the wind to deter other outlaws. Only it didn't work, and the bandits kept right on stealing, sometimes passing right under the bodies of their fellow outlaws to do it. Now, Bigfoot's fellow ranger, Creed Taylor, had a big spread lay west of San Antonio in the Cedar Hills, clear on the edge of Comanche territory, and he was constantly losing stock to bandits and Indian raids. The last straw came for Taylor the day the famous Mexican raider and cattle thief Badal and his gang rounded up a bunch of horses from his ranch and took them south toward Mexico. Most of the rangers were heading north to pursue some Comanches out on a raid, but Taylor and a friend went immediately in pursuit of the thief, and when they bumped into Wallace just below Uvalde, he joined them. Bigfoot was always ready to hunt horse thieves and desperados, especially those of Mexican descent, never forgetting what happened to his brother at Goliath. Bigfoot decided it was time to put an end to Badal's gang once and for all. He would track the wiry Mexican bandit to earth. The three men located the camp where the horse thief and his gang lay sleeping and snuck in from downwind so as not to alert the horses. Badal was wanted dead or alive, so all the thieves were shot and killed in the gunfight that followed. That was when Wallace got an idea. Obviously, hanging horse thieves hadn't gotten the message across to the outlaws riding the ranches of the good folk of Texas. Perhaps a more drastic example of frontier justice would do the trick. Severing Badal's head from his body, Bigfoot and his fellow ranger tied the body to the saddle of the wildest Mustang in the stolen herd and secured the severed head to the saddle horn so that it would bounce and flop around with every step taken by the Mustang. Then Wallace gave a shout and sent the horse running away with its headless dead rider, hoping the gruesome sight would deter future cattle thieves. What he managed to do was frighten everyone in South Texas. Folks would be peacefully walking down the road of an evening when a terrible headless rider would gallop past on a midnight black stallion with a serape blowing in the wind and severed head bounding on the saddle horn beneath its sombrero. Nothing could deter the terrible specter, not bullets, not arrows, not spears. It was years before a posse of cowboys finally grew brave enough to bushwhack the horse and release the weathered corpse from its back. But on moonless nights, the ghost of El Muerto continues to ride across South Texas to this day, with his long black serape blowing in the wind and his severed head bumping on the saddle beside him.
Burnt Church, retold by S.E. Schlosser. She was sophisticated, poised, and cultured. In retrospect, this should have made them suspicious. A teacher like her should be presiding over a girls' school in London or New York, not seeking a position in a small town in Georgia. But at that time, they were too delighted by her application to ask any questions. "It will be good for our daughter to learn some culture," the attorney's wife told the pastor's wife. "And our boy may find some table manners at last," the pastor's wife responded with a smile. School was called into session in the local church shortly after the arrival of the teacher, and soon the children were bringing glowing reports home. Teacher was special. Teacher taught them manners and diction as well as reading, writing, and arithmetic. All the children loved teacher. The parents were delighted by the progress their children were making at school. Teacher had been a real find, a godsend, said the preacher's wife. But not everyone in town was so satisfied. The local ne'er-do-well, called Smith, had more sinister stories to tell. "That woman ain't natural," he told the blacksmith, waving a bottle of whiskey for emphasis. "I seen her out in the woods after dark, dancing around a campfire and chanting in a strange language." "Nonsense," the blacksmith retorted, calmly hammering a heated iron bar on his anvil. "They say she's got an altar in her room, and it ain't an altar to the Almighty," Smith insisted, leaning forward and blowing his boozy breath into the blacksmith's face. "You're drunk," said the blacksmith, lifting the hot iron so it barred the man from coming any closer. "Go home and sleep it off." Smith left the smithy, but he continued to talk wild about the teacher in the weeks that followed. During those weeks, a change gradually came over the school children. The typical hijinks and pranks that all children played lessened. Their laughter died away. And when they did misbehave,
it was on a much more ominous scale than before. Items began to disappear from houses and farms. Expensive items like jewelry, farm tools, and money. When children talked back to their parents, there was a hard edge to their voices, and they did not apologize for their rudeness, even when punished. "And my daughter lied to me the other day," the attorney's wife said to the pastor's wife in distress. "I saw her punch her younger brother and steal an apple from him, and she denied it to my face. She practically called me a liar." "The games the children play back in the woods frighten me," the pastor's wife confessed. "They chant in a strange language, and they move in such a strange manner, almost like a ritual dance." "Could it be something they are learning at school?" asked the attorney's wife. "Surely not. Teacher is such a sweet, sophisticated lady," said the pastor's wife. But they exchanged uneasy glances. Smith, on the other hand, was sure. "That teacher is turning the young'uns to the devil. That's what she's doing," he proclaimed up and down the streets of the town. "Don't be ridiculous," the preacher told him when they passed in front of the mercantile. "I ain't ridiculous. You're blind," Smith told him. "That teacher ought to be burned at the stake, like they burn witches in Salem." The pastor, pale with wrath, ordered Smith out of his sight. But the ne'er-do-well's words rang in his mind and would not be pushed away. And the children continued to behave oddly, almost like they were possessed. He would, the preacher decided reluctantly, have to look into it some day soon. That day came sooner than he thought. The very next Monday, his little boy came down with a cold, and his mother kept him home from school. When the pastor returned from his duties for a late lunch, his wife came running up to him as soon as he entered the door. She was pale with fright. "I heard him chanting something over and over again in his bedroom," she gasped. "So I crept to the door to listen. He was saying the Lord's Prayer backwards." The pastor gasped and clutched his Bible to his chest as goosebumps erupted over his body. This was positively satanic, and there was nowhere the boy could have learned such a thing in this town, unless he learned it at school. At that moment, the attorney's wife came bursting in the door behind him. "Quick, Pastor, quick," she cried. "Smith is running through town with a torch, talking about burning down the school. The children are still in class." The pastor raced out of the house with the two women at his heels. They and the other townsfolk who followed them were met by a huge cloud of smoke coming from the direction of the church where the school children had their lessons. The building was already ablaze as frantic parents beat at the flames with wet sacks or threw buckets of water from the pump onto the inferno. Smith could be heard cackling unrepentantly from the far side of the building, which was full of the screams of the trapped students and their teacher. The fire blazed with a supernatural kind of force, and the pastor thought he heard the sound of the teacher laughing from within the building when it became apparent that no one could be saved. The church burnt for several hours, and when it was finally extinguished, there was nothing left. Mourning parents tried to find something of their children to bury, and Smith wisely disappeared from town, his mission against the works of Satan completed. The teacher's burnt body was buried deep in the ground and covered with a brick tomb. The children's smaller bodies were interred beneath wooden crosses. Of all the students in the school that fall, only the pastor's small son survived. To this day, voices can be heard in the graveyard at Burnt Church, chanting unintelligible words as the school children and the teacher once chanted in the woods outside town. Sometimes apparitions are seen, and dark walkers who roam the graveyard at night. And they say that a brick taken from the grave of the evil teacher can set fire to objects on which it is placed.
Auntie Greenleaf and the White Deer, a New York spooky story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Auntie Greenleaf was a scrawny old woman with a wild thatch of gray hair and a crooked nose. She lived in a hut surrounded by pines just outside Brookhaven, and she sold herbal remedies to the folks in town. Mostly, people avoided her, except when someone got sick, because it was said that Auntie Greenleaf was a witch. Her home remedies worked too well to be natural. Folks figured she had to have help from the devil or one of his familiars. There were many stories whispered in Brookhaven about Auntie Greenleaf. People said she had hexed a farmer's pigs once, after he spoke rudely to her, so that they all died, one right after another. One prominent citizen dreamed of Auntie Greenleaf, and the next morning her daughter fell ill with a fever and nearly died. It was also rumored that Auntie Greenleaf and her witch friends crossed the Atlantic in an eggshell and frolicked with the witches in England. Then they put a spell on the eggshell so that it brought them back here before sunrise. In the early fall, folks in town began talking about a large, pure white deer that was seen roaming the woods near Brookhaven at night. Several hunting parties were gathered to go after the large animal, but it seemed to be impervious to bullets, and folks began saying it was a phantom deer. Around about that time, several women in the town began having trouble with their churning, and a number of cows and pigs began to sicken and die. Folks blamed the incidents on the phantom deer, though each of the people afflicted with the trouble had crossed Auntie Greenleaf at some time in the last month. The men of Brookhaven got up a hunting party to chase down the animal. They were gone all day and well into the night. Finally, they spotted the white deer. It was the largest deer any of them had ever seen, and it was fast, too. They couldn't keep up with it. The men got several good shots in and swore that at least one of them hit the deer, but it just kept running. They returned home empty-handed. One local farmer became obsessed with the white deer. Every moment he could spare from his work, the farmer would take his gun and go hunting in the woods around town. He saw the white deer several times, but he and his shots always seemed to go astray. Finally, he decided the white deer must be a witch of some sort. The farmer melted silver to make bullets, and then he took his gun and went out hunting the white deer. He managed to make 3 shots with his silver bullets, and the white deer actually stumbled, as if one of the shots had hit it. Then it jerked upright and ran away. He tracked it almost to Auntie Greenleaf's hut, but then he lost it in the dark somehow, which was mighty strange, seeing as the deer was pure white. The next day, the farmer learned that Auntie Greenleaf was ill. From the moment she took to her bed, the local farm animals stopped dying, and the families who were having trouble with their churning were back to normal. Less than a week later, Auntie Greenleaf died, and the doctor who cared for her told the minister he found 3 silver bullets in her spine. After the death of Auntie Greenleaf, the phantom white deer was never heard of or seen again in Brookhaven.
And now for a few true tales.
Raining cats and frogs? Okay, so it may not be raining cats, but it definitely rains frogs occasionally, and it's been reported all over the world. The most likely explanation made by meteorologists is that a nearby windstorm sucked them up, and after moving them many miles, spits them back out again. You decide for yourself where these little guys come from.
According to W.A. Walker of Evansville, Indiana, in the summer of 1926, a young caddy at a local golf course recorded this frog fall. There had been a drought that summer, and the fairways were brown and dried up. One afternoon, a sudden storm came up, and a terrific thunderstorm followed. Rain came down in torrents, and with it, frogs about the size of nickels. They were alive and jumping, and there were thousands of them. The golfers and the young man couldn't believe their eyes as they watched thousands of frogs rain down from the sky. F.J. McManus of Laguna Beach, California, tells us, "I was raised on a farm in Minnesota, and as a boy, I remember a storm coming up. It looked serious, so we ran to the cellar. Afterwards, we went outside and saw our chickens eating tiny frogs and fishes."
from Bedford in the UK, according to the July 27, 1981 Bedfordshire Times, a Mrs. Vida McWilliam of Bedford found her garden hopping with little frogs after a rainstorm. Mrs. McWilliam wrote, "I can't remember the exact date, but it was June of 1979. One Sunday we had a really wet day, rain lashing down and very windy. It was damp and humid the next day as well. On my patio, near the caged area for my cat, I noticed what looked like half-grown tadpoles. To my surprise, there were little green frogs everywhere. It must have rained frogs that Sunday. Later in the week, my granddaughter and I went down to the garden to cut the lawn, and it was amazing. The grass was covered in little green frogs. We collected up the frogs and took them to the garden. All summer, my grandchildren and I carefully watched them as they made a home under the potting shed. I'm afraid last year, which was 1980, we had only three left, but they had grown to full size." And finally, D.F. Garner of Baltimore, Maryland, relates this tale. "About 35 years ago, while I was driving through a thunderstorm near Hershey, Pennsylvania, dozens of tiny frogs came down and pelted the hood of my automobile." Snakes, anyone? Next time you have that feeling of butterflies in your stomach, think about this story. Yeter Yildirim, a 15-year-old Turkish girl, had suffered from stomach pains for over 5 years. They were a constant torment to the girl. She had gone from a happy girl with lots of friends to a lonesome girl who suffered severe headaches and stomach pain. Her family was shunned by suspicious villagers in their little farming community. Eventually, Yeter's family moved 80 miles away because they were being persecuted by the town. As her symptoms worsened, her family finally took her to a hospital. The doctors x-rayed her and went to talk to her parents. They matter-of-factly stated that there would be no problem removing the snakes from the young girl's stomach. "What snakes?" asked her shocked parents. The x-rays showed three snakes living in the girl's stomach. Water snakes that she had apparently swallowed as eggs while drinking from a stream. They hatched and lived there for 5 years before being discovered as the cause of her sickness. They were slightly thicker than string and about a foot long each. She was fine after they were removed.
Listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.